Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
My guest is the best-selling author David Baldacci, whose latest Memory Man novel, Walk the Wire, is now available. Amos Decker is a former football player whose injuries rewired his brain, so now he remembers everything, including things he would rather forget. And Decker is an FBI agent now, and along with his partner Alex Jameson, travels to a fracking boomtown in North Dakota to investigate the gruesome murder of a woman whose body had already been autopsied by the time it was found. David, what's the attraction of one of these boom and bust towns, particularly in North Dakota, that makes it such a great setting for your novel?
Well, one, it's really out there, away from everything else. It's very isolated geographically. And the idea of sort of a wild, wild west place, and 2020 was intriguing to me, where, you know, the rules of civilization may not apply as strongly as they do everywhere else. And this idea of people, you know, going to that place, sort of rolling the dice that the oil is going to, you know, stay profitable and they're going to be able to make a lot of money really fast. And then lastly, whenever you have a situation like that, it happened in 1849 with the California Gold Rush, and it happened, you know, in this day and age, is when you have something like that, a boomtown where people are running to make a bunch of money, then all the bad elements follow them there. So you have a lot of crime that happens there as well. So that, you know, altogether was a nice mix, I think, for a mystery thriller for Decker to be thrown into and trying to figure it out, because this is a little town that has a lot of secrets.
The town itself is a fictional town of London, North Dakota, but did you travel to North Dakota or to get a lay of the land for one of these towns so you could observe it firsthand?
Yeah, it's a very distinct place, and depending on what side of the state that you're on as well. We're in northwestern North Dakota. You're really in the fringes of the Great Plains and the Badlands. So you have, you know, miles and miles and miles of nothing but flat land, and then interrupted by buttes and the fringes of the Badlands there. So geographically, it's really a beautiful place. But it's also very isolated. If you're a city person used to walking down a block in D.C. or New York or Boston where there's like, you know, 8,000 people around you, this is not that place. It is very isolated. But it's important business-wise because there's just a ton of oil and gas under there, and they figured out finally how to bring it up. So that's worth, you know, billions and billions of dollars. So that makes that spot in North Dakota very valuable.
You know, we saw a lot of conflict in the book, or read about not just the, usually it's the FBI agents coming into a small town and the conflicts between the local police department and the FBI. Here, really, everybody seems to have an issue with the FBI because nobody really knows why Decker is there to investigate. I mean, the FBI doesn't investigate local crimes. So why did you take that element of the conflict and make it between basically everybody in the FBI as far as not knowing?
Yeah, these days in particular, I wanted to build the intrigue, not just, you know, FBI versus the locals, but within the FBI itself, within the agency itself. And, you know, the times are very politically charged right now, and institutions that we feel should be independent from all of that aren't anymore. But one of the main reasons I did that was because it allowed me, later on in the book, to bring in another series characters from another book series to do it plausibly. So I really had to imbue into this novel a level of national security and national interest that would allow me to bring these other characters in. And also was a way to explain why the FBI was called in the first place for a local murder that normally local police would handle. So it had to do with this victim. The victim had something that was important to the federal government. And, you know, it would have been easier to just make it a local crime and they're called in for a reason that is simple. But I wanted the reason why they were called in to sort of be an integral part of the solution of this and also allow me to bring these like, serious characters into the plot.
The murder scene happens very early in the book, and Irene Kramer, the murder victim, is found in the woods while somebody is tracking a wolf, and her body had been already autopsied, and it's really a gruesome thing to even think about, but can you describe how it's set up in the book?
Yeah, so there's a hunter who's been hired to track down a wolf who's been raiding a herd of cattle, and it's at nighttime, and he's already shot the wolf, but didn't kill it. Now he's tracking the trail of blood. and he's going forward. It's hot and humid in North Dakota, even 11 o'clock at night, so you have to be very careful because there's nobody around to save you if you get dehydrated and collapse. And he sees a blood trail going off to the right, but then he sees a hump of something lying in the dirt to the left, and he doesn't know how that's possible. Then when he goes over, he sees it's the body, it's a woman, she's naked, and she has been autopsied. You know, the Y incision has been cut, the face has been taken off and groups down over the chest. Her brain is missing. He has no idea where that is. It's a horrific scene, and it strikes him. You know, anybody who's watched television shows knows that, oh, my God, you know, this woman has had a post-mortem performed upon her. So it's a chilling way to start the story. But I didn't do that just for dramatic effect. Every element of the crime scene has a good reason to be there, and it's something that Decker has to figure out along the way.
And I enjoy always reading about characters who have died early in the book, like Irene Kramer here, because we, to develop her character, we only learn about her in death, and so it's what people can find out. So how much different is that for a writer in character development when you're developing a character of somebody that's dead and you can only go by what they've left behind?
Yeah, it can be very challenging because one of the things when you have someone who's been brutally murdered, there should be an element of, I want justice for this person, even though you don't even know who she is or where she came from. So for me as a writer, I kind of went, you know, start at the end first. Here's the result. She's dead. Somebody killed her. All right, well, let's find out about her because I want readers to care about her, because if they don't care about her, then they're not really going to be interested in any, in the story that is trying to lead to her killer, because that's what Decker is interested in. So little by little, they try to fill in the back story of her life, you know, after we know that she's already dead, where she came from, why she was there, what she was up to, what was in her past that would make the federal government care so much about who she was and where she was. And so little by little, you feel in those details as Decker and Jameson find them out. And it kind of fills in the backstory of the woman. So all of a sudden, you know, during the course of the novel, she's not just a body that's been brutalized, but she was a real living human being who was killed and deserves justice.
The thing I also thought about when I read this is there were so many elements of the crime scene, of the death scene, that I wouldn't have even thought about until you wrote the words on the page, particularly the insect infestation of the body. And I have these images of, I think it's the University of Tennessee, I think, that has the body farm of where these dead bodies are studied. And so did that type of research come into how you describe this particular body?
Absolutely is. You know, people say the forensic scientists, you know, blue bottle flies are their, you know, pride and joy because they can tell so much. I mean, nature is very regimented in how it goes about doing what it does with something that has died. It's not willy-nilly. It doesn't change from, you know, victim to victim. It is the same. So entomologists can go in and, you know, with forensic scientists and say, okay, this is what happened. This is the time frame. So it allows, which is obviously very important for detectives, because the timing of the death is critical in determining who was where, who might be a possible suspect, where the victim was when they died, and what was the window of opportunity there. So nature helps immeasurably with that. And for me to be able to sort of allow the reader to follow through, I had to get them some sense of that. So I spent a little time on, you know, trying to dissect for them, okay, this is why this is important. And this is why Decker cares about it, and that's why you should care about it.
There's another interesting character in the book I found, Walt Southern. He's the mortician slash coroner for this little town in London, North Dakota, and he's the guy that prepares the bodies for burial. Plus, he's also the one that does the autopsies. So, is that something that comes up in a lot of small towns where the coroner and the mortician double? Because I thought it made a great fictional character.
Yeah, it happens quite a bit. I mean, small towns don't have the budgets in there for a full time. They don't have enough, you know, enough work for them to do. It's not like small towns have murders every day. So people who have some forensic ability, like a mortician, could also often double as coroners. And it depends on what state it is. There are two different types of statutes in the United States. One, I call them coroner states, where in order to autopsy a body, if you're a coroner, if you have some type of experience, you don't have to be licensed or regulated, have all the credentials. Other states are called medical examiner states, like Virginia is a medical examiner state. They have a chief medical examiner. There's a whole office protocol, regulations, certifications, licensing, and only certified medical examiners can perform postmortems on bodies. It varies different from state to state. As you can imagine, maybe a lot of the states in the middle of the country that are wide open spaces that have, you know, lots of land and very little population in these small towns, they can't afford that type of hierarchy. So a lot of, oftentimes, there are coroner states where coroners and morticians are one and the same.
And there's no sending the body off to the state capital to the medical lab for these type of states like there is in a lot, right?
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, if there's something in there that's troubling that they can't figure out, that the detectives in the case want more information, then most states have those resources where they can send it out to, you know, a medical examiner who's licensed, or they could even seek help from the federal government, and they can send a medical examiner to perform a more thorough postmortem on the body. Those are always options that are available. I would imagine every state has that. But for, you know, deaths that don't involve that complexity, and autopsies are, and not all autopsies are performed on everybody. That's not the case either. If you look at television, do you feel like there's a postmortem done on everybody who dies? No, that's not the case at all. It has to depend on the circumstances, and oftentimes postmortems are not done. That's not the usual thing. So you know, it just varies from state to state. But for the most part, unless there's something, you know, screaming out that we need more detail, and that first cut is the only cut.
I'm chatting with David Baldacci about his brand new Memory Man book, Walk the Wire. It's available now wherever your fine books are sold. David, you were planning on the massive book tour this time, and it was going to bring you to Omaha, Nebraska. You had a lecture scheduled at the University of Nebraska at Omaha that I know a lot of people around here had gotten tickets to, were looking forward to. It's not happening now due to coronavirus. What were you planning the lecture about?
I wanted to, you know, I was going to come out and talk about, I call it, you know, stories from the road and things that have happened to me over the course of, you know, 25 years of being a writer, meeting people, you know, having things happen, funny tales that have happened to me along the way. I try to be as entertaining as possible. I want to make it fun for people. I also want to make it substantive. I'll talk about my foundation, my charitable foundation. But mostly it's just sort of lighthearted. Let people have a good time talking about books and reading and writing and why it's so important to me, and just, you know, having some fun. And hopefully, you know, I know they want to reschedule it, and so it might be that I'm out there next year. Obviously, that my whole tour got canceled, but it should be. You know, these are challenging times. But yeah, we would have had a good time.
Well, and for somebody who writes like you do, where you pay attention to a lot of conversations as you travel around, this has got to be awful to, with all the social distancing, you aren't seeing those conversations that you would normally observe, right?
Yeah, I am definitely away from everybody. So it's in this isolation. You know, I spend a lot of time isolated anyway. It's self-imposed just because I spend a lot of time alone writing, as every writer does. But I also like the social moments, you know, going out, meeting people, going to places, seeing people, listening to conversations. That is a big part of it, too, and definitely I'm missing that right now.
There was another aspect of this book, back to the Walk the Wire, about a religious community called the Brothers Colony. It's an Amish-like group, and it reminded me of an Amish community that I've visited over in southeast Iowa. But can you kind of explain the features of the particular colony in your book?
Yeah, it's sort of a sect from the Hutterites. I think his name was James Hutter, I believe, from Germany, who sort of started it hundreds of years ago. And their philosophy is based on a part of the scripture where everything is communal. And they're unlike the Amish in that they can drive, you know, mechanized vehicles and all of that stuff. They can use real world things, you know, contemporary things, and they can drive trucks and use machinery and all that. But they live in a communal setting, so nobody owns any property at all. It's all part of, you know, that colony, as they're called. And there's one in the other side of North Dakota, in the eastern part of the state, northeastern part of the state. And I sort of patterned the one that was in the book on that colony. And in that same part of North Dakota, there's also a military installation that I patterned the one and Walked the Wire after, because I thought it was an incredible sort of, you know, coming together of very different types of people, where you could have a religious organization auction, bid on and win land that was next to a really secret military installation. So I just took all of that and plopped into the western part of the state in the middle of the Bakken shale oil region, which is where I needed it to be. And I thought the sort of the confluence of all of those elements are really fascinating. And so, yeah, it's just it's a communal organization, so they share everything, and they live very simply. And, you know, like a lot of organizations, I kind of laughed about it when I was researching it, that, you know, the men are the leaders of the organization and the women do all of the work. I was like, yeah, okay, well, nothing fair about that, but there you go.
Well, I just recently read a book about the Latter-day Saints and in living in Nauvoo, Illinois, and that seemed to be the theme there, too, is the women were doing all the work, but the men were the leaders. So it's nothing new in those organizations, right?
No, it's not.
The whole idea of having the military installation here, too, I thought it worked well because North Dakota is a great place to have a military outpost. But when you have the characters on a military base, I know you've spent time interviewing people. Did you have people in mind or personalities in mind who rise to the high levels in the high-ranking levels of these military organizations as you develop those characters?
Yeah, definitely. Over the years, I've done a lot of research and know a lot of people in all the service branches, both, you know, people from low ranks all the way up to four stars. And it gave me a good grounding in, you know, what elements it would take to work in those places, what it would feel like, and also the leadership rank. You know, even though the military is the military, it's also a highly political organization, and you can fall out of favor and very quickly, but also if something goes bad, there's also, you know, sort of circle the wagons mentality that comes in. So everybody, you know, they want to keep people away from things. If something's happening, they want to keep it with them. They don't want to air their dirty laundry. And there's also, look, you also have to realize there's a massive amount of money at stake in these places, too, that can be, for whatever reasons, exploited by people all over the place. And a lot of that happens in Walk the Wire. Just because I know that it happens in real life, too. People are greedy, and when you have a pot of gold there, people are going to try to pick their share and more if they can. And if it's not legal, you know, that really is not going to stop them either. And if they get caught, they'll try to, you know, point the finger at other people and, you know, cast blame away. But it makes for intriguing stories, that was for sure.
Absolutely. The book is Walk the Wire. It's David Baldacci's latest Memory Man book. The book's available now wherever your fine books are sold, as always from Grand Central Publishing. David, another fantastic offering, and thanks for joining us again to talk about it.
I appreciate it. I enjoy talking with you every time. Thank you.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.
Because you're mine, I walk the line.